David, Jeff, and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and this is the latest episode of The Three Horsemen for the end of the month of June, I guess. I'm losing track of where the hell we are in the year. I am joined, as always, by my co-host. Say hello, John Stevens.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm here. I'm tired.
Aren't we all? And in the other chair, as always, Mr. Fred Kish.
Good evening. It's Fred Kish, known as Fred Kish on Twitter, blogging at Bernal Alpha. And if you ever need a guidepost as to where you are in the horse universe, it is now currently episode 45.
Episode 45. My God, how the time flies. And our guest for this conversation is Nebula winner, Locus winner, two-time Campbell finalist, and hands down one of my favorite authors, Linda Nagata. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me. And by the way, that's three-time Campbell finalist.
Oh, ooh. My God, which one did I miss? Oh, I thought it was two. Oh, good Lord.
Go to the entry on the Internet Science Fiction Database and click on the little thing that says awards under the name.
I gotta hand in some of my geek cred now. This is terrible. I am very excited to have you on. You have a new novel out, The Last Good Man, which continues stylistically the near future warfighting stuff that you did with the Red Trilogy, except this is a bit more closer to home, and also this is much more of a procedural book too, which I really, really enjoyed as I was going through it. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and what led you to write it?
The book is about a very small company, a private military company. The main protagonist, her name is True Brighton, and she's one of the main characters in this company, and they set out on a rescue mission. They're hired to do a rescue mission. And during that mission, they find, by chance, some evidence that relates to a mission in their past 8 years prior. And that sets them off to uncover what actually happened. Because the story that True was told, is the past event, the story that True was told about it turns out not to be quite what she thought it was. So most of the book is her quest to figure out what's going on. And this is all amid changes in technology and in war fighting, where autonomous robotics are taking over what used to be the jobs of well-trained soldiers. So it is something of a mystery and something of a psychological thriller that's taking place in our imminent future.
Yeah, it was quite exciting. That whole first third of it there when we were seeing the prep work and stuff like that. I was really getting into it. What led you to something specific like this? I mean, the Red Trilogy still had an innate futurism running in the background. And
right.
this book was much more of a bleeding edge type of approach. You definitely had a degree of futurism in there with some, you know, next gen AI and stuff like that. But you really embraced a lot of the bleeding edge stuff that we're seeing these days and sort of extrapolated its future usage and stuff like that. Was that research or was that you just brainstorming?
It was a couple of things. Some of it was an attempt at marketing strategy, and let's look at it this way. I originally started on the idea because it seemed like the Red Trilogy was going to do fairly well in the market. So I figured instead of swinging wildly into some other direction, which is my typical modus operandi. That I might try to do something vaguely similar. So I settled on working with this private military company because I felt like that just gave me more freedom with the plot than going again with like a U.S. Army unit, like I did in the Red Trilogy. And, well, you know the saying that we live in a science fiction world.
Yeah.
And I am just fascinated and amazed and often frightened by developments that are going on right now and that are imminent. And I think a lot of science fiction tends to ignore that. And I'm really interested in it. At this point in my career, I don't really see why should I go into the far future and develop some new world when we have this amazing world right now that is obviously changing at a rapid pace. So I just look at that and I see it as a very fertile ground for stories. And then from the marketing point of view, I had real hopes that I could position this novel so that it would be cross-genre and would appeal both to science fiction readers and to readers of techno thrillers.
Yeah, I was as I got right around the middle part of the book when they're really discussing the role of AI and how it's sort of taking over more and more of the jobs and how it's actually sort of governing the actual relationship between combatants as well as the private industry against the government, stuff like that. You know, I definitely got a bit of a Daniel Suarez vibe there. Like, wow, this is definitely going to appeal to that particular type of reader who likes reading that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Are you gonna be doing more books with any of these characters?
I haven't really decided. I really felt this is a standalone novel.
Mm, yeah, you know, certainly, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I've been asked if I'm going to use the main character, True Brighton, in another story. And I had thought not. I actually sketched out an idea for a novel using one of the secondary characters. I kind of put that on the side when this book didn't get a New York publisher. Because it didn't suddenly seem as marketable as I thought it was. So.
Oh, what do those New York publishers know?
Well, hopefully nothing.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because we the last month on the show we were talking to some people about self-publishing, and you've got a long history of self-publishing. And when you approach a project like this, I'm just kind of curious about. We ask people in the industry what's going on in their heads when they're writing a book and then looking at releasing it and marking it and wearing all the hats at once.
Well, I tend to focus on one project at a time. I'm not very good at switching back and forth between different things. So, and also I have a really, I don't know if I should call it a bad habit or not, but the way I usually write is that I will just go ahead and write whatever book I want to write, and then I'll try to sell it. Whereas most writers will write a proposal and try to sell that. So that's what I did with this one. I just sat down and decided this is what I wanted to do. I'm going to write it. So while I was working on it, when I first started, I had a lot of work left that I needed to do with the Red Trilogy. That was being published by Saga at that point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I had editorial revisions and copy edits and proofs and promotional things to do at that time. So it was really distracting. And then finally, that stuff was done, and I really just focused in on finishing The Last Good Man. And at that point, I sent it to my agent, who loved it. And he sent it out into the world, and I'd been kind of 50-50 on whether I would actually sell it or not. But as it turns out, we did not get a good offer on it. So I decided that, you know, I was going to go ahead and publish it myself. And in some ways I was relieved because, you know, as we were talking about, it's a very near future book, and I really didn't want it sitting around for a year waiting for a publication date.
Yeah.
So at that point, what I did, was I sent it to another editor, a freelance editor, to look at, and responded to her critiques on it. So it went through a couple more edits and had it copy edited. And during that time, I actually started getting it ready to go out in the ARC version that I think Fred has.
We all do.
We all do. Okay, great. And you know, and that was all, that was print and ebook. So I laid both of those out myself, and bugged a whole bunch of people and asked them if they wanted a copy of it. And once those had gone out, the copy edit was done. So I went through it again, laid it all out again, got it ready to, you know, for its final version. And it's a lot of detail work along the way. When I first started to self-publish, which was back around 2010 or 11, at that time I hadn't been writing for quite a few years, and I took my older books, like the Nanotech Succession, and I started converting them into ebooks. They'd never been in ebooks before, and I created my own print versions of those, and it was a whole lot of fun back then. I really enjoyed it, because I'd been working in HTML and websites for years. I basically already had the skills that I needed to do this, so I enjoyed the whole process. I really liked the control of it, that, you know, I could go in and fix stuff instead of having to ask an editor in New York to ask somebody else to fix something. and it was a whole lot of fun. But I have to say that now in 2017, it's a whole lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite as much fun as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's easier to convert something you've already written several years before than to take it from end to end.
No, actually, it's not really.
Well, you're not. You've already written it, and it was out there in the world, and you know. So that's what I meant by that. Like the Boar Maker, mm-hmm. you converted, but you weren't going from a year long writing process to then turning it into a book. You already had a book to a certain point.
That's true, but I had to get the manuscript. You know, I had been updating the manuscript over the years for my new word processing programs.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, there was a lot of little junk code that was stuck in there, so I had to clean all that out and then go through my my actual printed out copy edited manuscripts and transfer all the copy edits into my files. So that was actually a fairly tedious process.
I also wanted to mention, I would be remiss if I did not mention, that you have a story in John Joseph Adams' Cosmic Powers anthology, which is certainly a world away from the near future techno horrors of Last Good Man. Diamond and the World Breaker, the Cosmic Powers anthology, we talked about it last month, was aimed at a great big widescreen cosmic entities and crazy technology and stuff like that. And you slipped into that fairly easily, I would say. I love that story. I love the visuals in it.
Well, I'm glad you liked the story, because that story was incredibly hard to write. No, John has this thing he does where he'll come and he'll ask me to write a story of a kind that I've never written before. And because I try to keep in mind the idea of try new things, mm-hmm. I tend to say yes. And the last time he did that was, it was for his military fantasy anthology.
Yep.
And I wrote a story for that called The Way Home.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I really liked that story. And I never would have written it if John hadn't asked for a military fantasy story. So he came along with this, and he says, you know, we want to do this really fun anthology of galaxy-spanning stories. And I took a deep breath, and I said, okay. and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and the deadline was getting closer, and I sat down and I tried to write stuff, and I could not make myself write a story with hyperspace in it.
I mean,
this is what comes of growing up in the school of Gregory Benford.
Well, true.
And I just didn't want to do it, and so I finally sat down and constructed this universe with the story world within the solar system, which had most of the stuff that John wanted, but there was no faster than light travel. So basically, I had to design an entirely new story world to write that one short story.
Wow! So, no, that was good. I'm sitting here and I'm realizing, yeah, the way home. I know I heard an audio version of that, and I forget what podcast it was on.
It was probably at Lightspeed,
mm-hmm.
because the story was reprinted there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would be it.
Hey, do you find short stories to be more work than novels because you're doing all the inventing, but you don't have the space to make it pay, as it were?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they were harder than novels, but what you just said is absolutely true. Yeah, I find them very challenging. And, you know, especially if I'm not working in an already invented story world. Because then everything's up for grabs. Everything's open.
Mm-hmm.
So usually I'll try to set them in a story world that exists in a novel, if I can get away with that at all.
Wow.
But they're a lot of work for the return on investment.
Now, one thing that I've always appreciated is that, I mean, you've done I guess we could call it in general the hard SF nanotech sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But then you destroyed your career by writing fantasy.
No, I'd already destroyed my career by not writing at all.
Well, I was curious. I thought that maybe you had just gotten caught up in the whole mid-list implosion, unfortunately, that seems to have sidetracked so many people. Oh, so many people. But destroyed your career again by getting into military science fiction.
Right, exactly. So right now I'm kind of sitting around looking for the next direction in which to destroy my career.
Well, maybe cosmic travel with hyperspace.
With hyperspace, there we go.
I mean, they've got a new Star Trek series coming out, so.
Right, reinvent myself.
Hyperspace will be hot again.
Trust me, the three of us are well acquainted with destroying our careers. Yep. So. I think John's actually going to write a how-to book on it. Yep. So,
yeah.
But I was curious. I mean, a lot of people, I think, will almost like, if you look at, I can't remember the name of the author, but a lot of people just use different pseudonyms whenever they move into a different area. Did you ever think about that? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I wrote the two little fantasy novels, when I published the first one, I did actually publish it under a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
But it made no difference at all in sales, which were extremely minimal.
Okay.
So I just eventually threw up my hands and republished it under my own name.
But, yeah. Was...
What?
Go ahead, John. Jeff, sorry.
Go ahead, Fred.
Well, I was
just going to say what. Okay, Fred, you go.
No, after you.
Okay.
But all right.
Trust me, we'll edit all this out.
Related to not using pseudonyms, the Red originally came out self-published.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's how I first read it. And I probably still have the copy on my disc somewhere, you know, the ebook version. And then it was republished and the rest of the trilogy came out under Saga. And
mm-hmm.
of course, your earlier stuff was originally like with Bantam Spectrum and places like that and then republished. I mean, do you, Do you see things like self-publishing as being a way of not only continuing your career, but ensuring that, you know, given the upturns and downturns of publishing in general, it's a good way of just making sure that your backlist is available?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, even back in the 90s when the nanotech books were coming out, they would come out and just go out of print in, I think it was like a year or two. It was very short. My first novel, The Boar Maker, was out maybe 9 months. And I got heard from my editor that all the and this was in the days before ebooks. And I heard from my editor that all the warehouse copies had been accidentally remaindered. So the book was basically out of print. And that was it. That was it for the book. And it went on to win the Locus Award for Best First Novel. And so Bantam decided, well, maybe they would print a few more thousand copies. And, you know, that's how, can I say, how tight careers were back then.
Right.
So, you know, I went on to do the three other nanotech books, but they went out of print pretty quickly. And I mean, one of the few actually smart things that I did in my career was as soon as they were out of print, I would send in a letter asking for my rights back.
Okay.
So I had all the rights back to all of my books by the time that the whole self-publishing thing took off. And so those books had not been available for years. And even back in, you know, before self-publishing was a thing, I had decided that I was going to do a 10-year anniversary edition of Vast, which was my fourth novel. And I actually sat down at that time and I more or less learned how to use InDesign, at least well enough to lay out a completely text novel. But I never quite got around to it because, you know, the whole print-on-demand thing wasn't really happening quite yet.
Right.
But, you know, again, that was another step that when self-publishing did finally come around that had helped me prepare for it because I went back and, you know, reworked with InDesign and caught up on what I had learned. So yes, none of those books would be available except in used bookstores at this point if I hadn't put them out myself.
I think the problem is you're always ahead of the curve.
Yeah. I've been told that before. Yeah.
You're ahead of the curve on nanotechnology and military and strong female characters. Well, and
it's funny because, well, it's not funny, but it's something that I've noticed. We've talked a lot about on the show over the years, you know, our favorite parts of the genre and our favorite parts of history. And aside from our, you know, formative teenage years, my sweet spot for SF always was the back end of the 90s when it was, you know, you and Jeffrey Carver and Catherine Acero and George Zabrowski and all these people that were doing a lot of space-based stories without actually veering into the new space opera. And that was really one of the real sweet spots for me when it came to the genre. But so many of the authors that really made a splash at that point ran into the same thing that you did. Yeah, you never saw Jeffrey Carver books on the shelf a year after they came out. And David Zindel books vanished almost immediately when they came
out. That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Jeff Carver is over at Book View Cafe along with me, by the way.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a when I think about that, when I think about short shelf life and when I think about doing this stuff now, what is your do you have a takeaway when it comes to the industry now and whether it's more fickle than it was or whether it's more accommodating? Not necessarily specifically fandom because that, you know, self-publishing goes all over the place. But what's your impression of the way that the SF landscape right now when it comes to books is playing out?
I don't know. I think fantasy is so dominant nowadays. If you look at the awards list,
yeah,
it seems like, you know, these are a lot of very fine novels are coming out, and it seems like the majority are fantasy. You know, there's been some really interesting science fiction lately too. Yoon Ha Lee's books.
Oh yeah. Yep.
And Infomocracy.
Yep.
There's another very near future book. Those are the two that spring to mind. But you know, whether the industry itself has changed, I don't know. It seems like very traditional science fiction is still quite popular. The galactic spanning stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of indie writers who write very quickly, put out a lot of books every year, mm-hmm. and dominate the top of the bestseller lists on Amazon. And a lot of those are, they're 99 cent books, $1.99. I can't write like that, you know? No, I write slowly. It takes me quite a while. Usually up to a year to get a book out, so. I mean, to write a book, much less get it out. So it's interesting. And then, you know, publishing is, I think, a lot like it always was, in that if you're a new writer, you can get a lot of excitement going around your work. Your publisher can get a lot of excitement going around it. And, you know, you'll have that shot, a book, maybe two or three. And if they don't make money, it could be just like the 90s, where, you know, suddenly the doors are not opening for you. So, you know, it's a business. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah. But you never know. Sometimes it just seems like some books get a whole lot more promotion than others. So that's mm-hmm. always the mystery to writers. It's like.
Right.
Well, John certainly knows about about the fickleness of the industry.
Not me. But my question about, you know, changes in the publishing industry would be, do you think with the advent of ebooks and the ease of publishing backlists that some publishers are taking advantage of that and maybe giving some writers who may not have had that kind of boost in the past, the boost now?
A boost in the sense that they're promoting them?
Yeah, that they're making their books available.
Like
you were saying earlier, like back in the 90s, I think it still probably holds true to an extent today. You know, a book would be on the shelf for a certain amount of time, and then it would get pushed out because there are more books coming. You know, after an initial, you know, sales rush, sales often drop off, and it becomes too prohibitively expensive to store and print and distribute. And I'm just wondering, like, with the advent of ebooks, I know for self-publishers, getting control of their books and publishing their backlist has been a big boost, but do you see publishers doing that for authors as well?
Well, I think the question is phrased a little incorrectly, because...
Okay. No, I'm always
because...
right.
Because these days... most publishing contracts, my understanding, is that they will have a clause because of ebooks, because ebooks are infinite. You don't run out of them. That the reversion clause usually says something like, if we sell less than $200 a year or something like that, then you can ask for your rights back. Mm-hmm. And the amount is so tiny. That
right.
It's not that, you know, it's not that hard to reach. But now I don't know this is true. I've kind of not looked into it, but I've heard that there are publishers who, if they feel a book that they have out in ebook is not mm-hmm. selling well enough, that they will just knock it down to $1.99 and move enough copies to hit the cutoff.
Okay,
so
you will never
get your right back. Yeah. So, you know, it's
bad.
So the publishers, yeah, all those books are out there. You know, they're available in right. ebook version, and that's a good thing. But it doesn't really advantage the writer very much.
Okay.
Necessarily.
That's what I was curious about.
Yeah.
What you'd seen in that regard. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, I'd like to move away from publishing. I mean, you mentioned Greg Benford. who would you consider some of your influences to have been?
Well, yeah, I mentioned Greg Benford. Used to read a lot of Greg Bear.
Okay.
And I still read a lot of Greg Bear. I've enjoyed his War Dogs series.
Yes.
I still need to read the third one on that.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Well, back in the 90s, there was Greg Egan and Kathleen Goonan,
mm-hmm.
Will McCarthy.
Oh, yeah.
Maureen McHugh.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. You guys are really stretching my memory here. But there was a lot going on back then. Walter John Williams.
Yep.
You know, the whole Hyperion books, Dune. I grew up reading science fiction.
Okay.
So there's a whole lot of books back there that have faded into the mists of memory.
So. I'm pretty sure I've got more mists than you do, but you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what? Did you take something in college that led you to move towards the hard SF, especially like the nanotechnology end of thing? Or, I mean, I'm just trying to figure. I'm wondering why. I mean, how I knew you
mm-hmm.
was that kind of story, along with like you mentioned Will McCarthy. I mean, he was big on, you know, the Crushing the Moon and all those other books, and you know, so that seemed to be like this hot thing for a while was the nanotechnology and things like, you know, that kind of, not cyberpunk, you know, just manipulating matter and things like that. I mean, was mm-hmm. there something that drove you that way?
Yeah, it was, Eric Drexler's book.
Okay. There we go. Which is,
yeah,
I think, sadly out of print at the moment, I think.
Is it really?
I believe
yeah,
so.
Yeah, it was, yeah, in college, I majored in biology and actually got my degree in zoology. And then I know I was reading Analog after college, and I'm sure that's where I first heard of Drexler's book. I think there was an excerpt in there,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. it just blew me away. So I went out and got the book and read it, and I knew I had to be writing, you know, following some of these ideas. And for me, it was interesting because what I did was I took a lot of my biology background, cell biology, biochemistry, and evolution, and kind of used that bio perspective, combining it with the nanotechnology that Drexler was talking about. So that's really where the nanotech books came from.
Okay.
As you say that, the thing that kind of sticks out in my mind is that especially Vast was you were so good at conveying the impending sense of dread of the big scary unknown, and that was something that I definitely read into on Last Good Man, wherein vast uncharted volumes of space become replaced with unseeable protocols and interactions between machines that are half a world away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the tentativeness of taking that next step into uncharted territory was something that I think I've seen thread through quite a few of your books. And in reading this book, I was like, oh yeah, this is I know this vibe, I know this chord, this works well here. So.
Yeah, I think in a lot of my books, it's not really written as a warning or something. It's more written as this is a proposed technology. This is what it might be able to do. How are people going to deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
So with The Last Good Man, there's a lot of autonomous robotics, war fighting machines, surveillance. And a big theme of the book is, you know, this is the way it is. And, you know, if you look around us as the world as it is, that's where we're going. What is that going to mean? What is that going to mean for society, for people? How will people react to it? Mm-hmm. So that was a big theme behind the book.
Well, that was kind of where I was going to go next was, I mean, You did a lot of nanotechnology and stuff in the earlier years, and then with the Red Trilogy, I mean, you not only covered AI, but you also covered military sort of stuff. So, and it's kind of too early to talk about this as far as Last Good Man, but have you, like, noticed, you know, with the Red Trilogy, did you get a lot of feedback from people in the military about that? Or have you gotten, I mean, I know Will McCarthy, for example, went on to do some startup stuff with nanotech. So, have you gotten feedback from that industry on your stuff, or conversations with young soldiers about, you know, the characters out of the Red Trilogy, or even, I mean, you may have gotten some feedback on what you've heard from The Last Good Man at this point.
Yeah, well, I've gotten, you know, I haven't gotten feedback in the sense, I guess what I've had is some very positive comments from people in the military. And I've had people who've, you know, soldiers who seem to have really enjoyed the Red Trilogy. And
Military person will also add his endorsement.
Well, thank you.
There you go.
And yeah, even with The Last Good Man, yeah, I've gotten some positive feedback on that. And that is really satisfying, I have to say. You know, I didn't grow up in a military family per se. You know, my father had been a World War II pilot, but he hadn't been directly involved with the military. Oh, I shouldn't say that. He worked civil service for the Navy his entire career, but it wasn't like we lived on military bases or anything. And then suddenly I found myself with my son in the Navy and my son-in-law in the Army. So, you know, that was a bit of a transition for me. But even so, it's not like I had personal experience in the military, and I really had wanted to do it right. So it was very gratifying that, you know, some of my readers who were serving seemed to think that the books did their job in that respect.
Have you heard of anybody using the books, either those books or the earlier books, for example, like in an academic setting, or to spark a conversation about the ethics of nanotechnology or biology or AI or anything like that? Has that come out yet? Or?
For the newer books, I'm not directly. I know that they've been recommended on, like, August Cole has been, authors of Ghost Fleet.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, he's been promoting the list. He does a lot of work with military units. As for academics, I know that The Boar Maker has been used several times in classrooms.
Oh.
So that's
Ooh,
been
really?
Really nice. Yeah. And even until recently, I mean, probably since I republished it, probably 4 or 5 times. So that's been really nice. That's
all you got to do.
After all these years,
get something on the USMC professional development reading list, and you'll be in print forever. Look at that Thucydides guy; he's still in print.
Oh yeah, he's probably not getting royalties anymore.
No,
though.
That's true.
Yeah,
but Robert Strassler, who did the annotated version, I think that's the main reason his edition's been in print. It's on that list. So there you go. That's neat.
Right.
I mean, you know, part of the conversation I think always is, you know, you talk about some of the technologies being deployed. So you wrote the story to talk about it. So I always like to hear that it's making an impact. I mean, when we talked to David Weber, for example, he's told the story that he knew of someone who, I don't know whether she got the appointment to the U.S. Naval Academy or what, but her model was Honor Harrington. And, you know, as far as, like, you know, as being a model of the kind of officer she would like to be. So that's how she got to the Naval Academy was basically, you know, that was what she was shooting for, to be the wet Navy version of Honor Harrington.
Uh-huh. So, oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. You know, and I know people that have, I have a friend who got through basic training, partly because of things like Starship Troopers, believe it or not. So
one of the things that leaps out when I hear about stuff like this is that, you know, you talked about the War Dogs books, and I think about that and the Red Books and Last Good Man. And so often when you're reading military blogs or hearing, you know, or seeing these opinion pieces regarding the technological advancements of the military and what kind of impact they're having on the psychology of soldiers or the remote pilots or how much of the moral authority of war do we want to hand over to algorithms and protocols. And people keep coming back to this whole idea of we need to be having a conversation about that. And when I look at this, you know, this wealth of military techno thriller, bleeding edge stuff that's being released, and it's, you know, I'm not saying it's overwhelming, but there's definitely a considerable movement in that direction. I'm saying, look, this conversation is being had right now. I mean, Last Good Man talks about the actual impacts, not only of misinformation, but also about how automating the relationship between private firms and the government can really lead to some ramifications that we're not, you know, that are not being addressed. It seems to me that every time you hear somebody say we need to have an ethical discussion about this, there's always been already a number of science fiction books discussing it.
I was just going to say it's kind of interesting because despite that technology is advancing so quickly on a day-to-day basis, it may be slow enough that people accept, you know, each little minor incremental change until suddenly they realize how different today is from a year ago or 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. All right, Fred, do you have anything else, or are we going to move on to culture consumed here?
I think we can do that. I mean, I will.
Okay.
I will wrap though by saying I really enjoyed. That's why I appreciate the fact. I was kind of joking about you saying that you destroyed your career, because I really enjoyed the earlier books. And I was so excited to see you come back with Red, and I was so excited to see you come back with this one as well. You know, I never have understood this whole thing about, well, you know, you're known for X, therefore you can't write Y. I mean, I'd rather not reread X, X plus one, X plus two, because after a while you get bored. You know, so I appreciate
that's how
the
I
author,
am too.
You know, reinventing themselves. So, well, can't wait for.
I got
the
one
next
fan.
One. Oh, you've got more than one fan. Come on.
Oh, trust me, I'm about as close to an Uber fan as you're probably going to get. Like I said, I think I have probably four different versions of Vast kicking around here in one format or another. So.
Well, thank you.
So, we've been talking a lot about influences and things like that. I was just curious if Freddie or John or Ann Linda, if anything's been on your radar lately, genre or non-genre wise, that's really made an impact. I'll talk to John first because he hasn't said much.
I just started reading Born.
Ah, Vanderbilt.
Ah.
Okay.
So, yep. And yeah, it's definitely. Something that's going to have an impact on me, I think.
Yeah. Hurry up so we can talk about it.
Yeah. the funny thing is, like, I liked the Southern Reach books, but they didn't really affect me the way some of his earlier books have and some of his other writing has. But this feels like it's going to, because it's just really, he's really got a pretty sophisticated voice. He's really got the voice down. He's really got a good tone down, and there's a strong sense of, I think, of what he wants to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So those are all very encouraging things. And I'm actually rereading a lot of Judith Merrill right now.
Oh.
Because I might be on a panel at ReaderCon on her work.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I just last week at the bookstore found a copy of Best of SF from 62, the year I was born. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty eye-opening how many stories that were in there that I didn't read for the first time until deep into the 70s. And I was like, wow, I had mm-hmm. no idea all these came out in 62.
Yeah.
I think I'm only missing two of her best ofs right now.
Mm-hmm. I see. I'm going through the best of Judith Merrill.
If only Jeff, but I'm also you knew a bookseller who might be able to help you.
It is possible that I have some of those in my inventory.
If you don't mind me asking, what's the ReaderCon panel about?
It's just like she's the I think she's the past guest, the ghost guest.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So what they do for all the guests is there's always a panel on each of the guests' work. Ooh. So there's one on Naomi Novik. There's gonna be, you know, and there's one on Judith Merrill. So I enthusiastically signed up for it. We'll see if I get it or not. But it's giving me an excuse to go reread some Judith Merrill. So I'm reading, you know, I'm reading the best of Judith Merrill right now. But I'm also reading a couple of her anthologies. Like I'm reading England Swings right now, which I've never read before. So I'm quite interested to see how that goes. And then, you know, I'm reading someone who's been pretty influential. I'm getting back into Jerusalem. I started reading it. I had to take a break.
Alan Moore.
made your head hurt.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot to take in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even some kind of vast panoramic sweep. It's just the... It's in the details, and the details are just, I would say, sometimes exquisite, sometimes excruciating. which I think is, you know, probably intentional on his part, because Alan Moore does like to torture his readers.
Yes.
And I really think that's part of his modus operandi, is that he really likes to put his readers through the ringer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's sort of characterized, like, that's what I feel about the Lovecraft comics, is that he did those in part because he just really wanted to unsettle people. Yeah, and with the approach he took to them, especially Neonomicon. Especially Neonomicon. I have not read Providence, but I am waiting for the omnibus to come out so I can get it all at once.
I'm certain there'll be about 8 different versions of it. So.
And lose sanity points, you know, en masse. And the last thing is, where is it? I'm still reading Paul Kincaid's book on Ian Banks.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I have not quite finished it yet. Yeah, but it's good.
Full report on that.
It's good. I mean, Kincaid is a really good critic, and he's really thought hard about Banks, so it's really interesting to read.
Linda, I know you've been busy publicizing Last Good Man, but has anything been popping up on your radar lately? Anything that?
Well, I spend a lot of time with audiobooks these days, and
yeah, so do I.
Yeah, and given the series American Gods, which I have not seen, I decided to go back and do that again. But instead of reading it, I listened to full cast audiobook.
Oh, yes.
And it was fantastic.
Yes.
Really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And
if you haven't heard the audiobook version of Anansi Boys, that's also really well done.
I'm actually listening to that one
okay.
right now. Yeah.
Well, then I'll recommend, Neverwhere was another very good full cast.
Yeah, I was about to say the full cast on Neverwhere was really awesome.
Yeah.
I'll have to add that in. I'm having a hard time keeping up with my credits.
I think Gaiman dramatizes well for the most part. Like they're like Neverwhere was okay to read, but I really liked both the full cast and the graphic novel, the graphic series better.
Yeah.
Than I did the book.
Yeah.
Or the story.
I mean,
for me,
I agree.
The Southern Reach trilogy. I listened to that on audiobook.
Yes.
I would like to listen to that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed it that way. I'm not sure I would have enjoyed it as much if I were reading it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was very well done in audio.
Yeah, the narrator they had on that first one was excellent. Mm-hmm. She did a fantastic job on that one.
Excellent.
And then...
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird you say that because I read the first two of the Three Body Problem books. I read them in ebooks, but Death's End I'm listening to was an audiobook, and it really does change your relationship with the story when it's being told to you.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say another book.
I'm sorry,
that,
Linda. What else?
I was just gonna add one more book, which is neither science fiction nor fantasy, but I listened to an audio, and I just really really enjoyed it. And it is a thriller called Summit by Harry Farthing. And it's a dual plot line story. One side takes place in World War II, and the other is in the modern era and has to do with summiting Mount Everest. Hmm. So if you, like me, like climbing books, climbing terrifies me, which is why I think I like the books. That Summit by Harry Farthing.
Okay.
And he actually narrates the audiobook himself and does an excellent job with it.
Fred, how about you?
All right, well, I am reading Harlan Ellison short fiction for a project which may or may not come to be this year. And I recently started looking at Samuel R. Delaney again because, Lord help me, I've had an idea for another sub-podcast called the Samuel R. Delaney Literary Podcast. And I think Mr. Stevens has expressed interest in that at some point.
Oh, yeah.
And to take my mind off of life in general, of college prep and high school ending and even vaster events of recent note, I started reading some Glenn Cook again. I mean, I love, as people have known, who know me know, I love his Black Company series as being fantastic military fantasy. You know, very realistic and very gritty and, you know, just very good stuff. But speaking of people who shoot themselves in the career, I also utterly love his Garrett P.I. series. So I've gone through the first, I think, three or four of them. So Sweet Silver Blues, Bitter Gold Hearts, and Cold Copper Tears. And I'm reading the fourth one now. And it's like, you know, I think since the last time I read them, which was pretty much when they first came out, you know, I now see the influences. So, for example, Cold Copper Tears is oh so clearly the Maltese Falcon, because you've got the mysterious female who has multiple identities, and you've got the mysterious treasure, and you've got various, you know, characters that keep popping up wanting him to do various things. And, you know, so it's just like, oh, yeah, this is the Maltese Falcon, but with elves and dragons and, you know, elder gods and things like that. So, and otherwise, I don't think we're still working our way through X-Files, which is a rewatch for myself and my wife, but the first time through for my daughter. And we're watching the new Doctor Who, the new season of Doctor Who. And on the daughter front, she is now reading, my goodness, Dune. So,
ooh.
Yay.
Which a friend of mine popped in from England this morning, oddly enough, and he's like, oh, I heard that Dune was branded the favorite novel of the goth movement. I'm like, no, actually, that's they were talking about the movie version. David Lynch, not the book. Yeah.
The one where they wear black steel suits,
yes,
against the white sand.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So that is my culture consumed.
That's funny. I talked last time about reading October, the Story of the Russian Revolution by Chana Mieville. And the beginning of that book, the first few chapters, he does such a good job talking about sort of like what the state of pop culture was in Russia before the revolution actually happened. So I started poking around looking for some Russian literature and came across Worlds Apart, an anthology of Russian fantasy and science fiction by Alexander Levitsky, which came out in 2007, I think, and have been making my way through the first few sections of that, talking about utopian models and the early fantasy trips into space that a lot of utopian and fantasist writers from the last 200 years sort of played with. And it's one of those rather eye-opening things that I actually find myself wondering how much of the stuff that I'm reading here was actually taught in schools and stuff like that. I mean, we have so little of the fantastic when I was in a grammar school, and so many of these stories seem to be, you know, right. So, you know, sometimes they're beat you over the head allegories, but other times they're just these wonderful little dreamlike snippets. So that's been pretty much eating up the bulk of my time. And I talked about the comic God Country last time. The last issue of that came out, and oh, did it stick the landing. It is utterly heartbreaking. I cannot recommend it enough. I'm certain the trade paperback will be out soon, but when it comes to a exploration of loss and potential loss and wanting to hang on to the things that appear to be slipping away, couched in the story of an angry god trying to get his sword back from the Texas farmer who currently has it. I cannot say enough about it. It's probably one of my favorite comics that's come out in the last few years, and it came out of nowhere. I had no lead up to it whatsoever. I just read the first issue, and it had me all the way through. So, and given how utterly crappy so much of what's coming out of Marvel and DC has been lately, it's good to have a nice little simple self-contained story that really has you reaching for the hankies when you get to the end. So that's about for me. Linda, I so want to thank you for doing this with us. I'm so happy we had you on, and I'm so happy this book is out.
Thanks very much for asking me, and I know it was a scramble to try to get everybody online at the same time.
No. We learned that from Patrick Hester. We learned how to do our technical meltdowns from the finest. So. And also, we cannot get through an episode of this show without mentioning Paul Weimer. And I happen to know that Paul Weimer loved Last Good Man because he said so on the blurbs. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming on. And I really wish you the best of luck on this. And I'm really hoping to see a lot more, whether it be in this venue or Faster Than Light Fantasy Dragons or whatever.
There we go.
Yeah. Ooh. Sell that storyline.
Your site is Mythic Island.
Mythicisland.com. Yep.
Mythicisland.com. And is everything of yours currently available through there, or most of your books?
All the novels, and I'm just holding back on a couple of short stories. I have big plans for them, which I've had for the last 3 years and haven't done anything.
Please do another collection. So. Excellent. Well, I'm very glad we had you on. Gentlemen, anything else to add?
No.
Stay tuned, because we will be back real soon after this episode drops with, oh my goodness, another episode.
Another?
Yes.
Number 46.
Yes. Not to give anything away, but we will be donning capes that time. There you go.
Ooh. Very good. I have a selection of capes. I don't know which one I'll wear. So. All right. Well, I hope everyone's summer is treating them well and they're not suffering the miserable humidity that the Southeast is currently having. And I hear the Northeast as well from Fred. Yep. So.
Oh, yeah. We got a little here, too.
Yeah. Hopefully everybody's summer is temperate. And until next time, I'd like to thank everybody for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night. Night.